Welcome to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. I'm June Grosso. Every day we bring you insight and analysis into the most important legal news of the day. You can find more episodes of the Bloomberg Law Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts. You've never seen corporations marching in the streets with signs to gain their civil rights as women and African Americans have. Theirs was a quiet civil rights movement. Just how quiet? The first Supreme Court case over the rights of corporations dates back to 1809, a half century before similar cases on the rights of African Americans and women. Adam Winkler, a professor at UCLA Law School, joins me now. His new book is We the Corporations: How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights. Let's start with the basics, Adam. What rights do corporations have today?
Well, corporations have a wide variety of rights under the Constitution. There's been a lot of debate since Citizens United about the idea, are corporations people? And there's been a lot of attention paid to the constitutional free speech rights of corporations since that 2010 decision. But the truth is, corporations have been fighting to win individual rights under the Constitution since America's earliest days, and they've won a wide variety. They were influential in shaping the contract clause in early America, fought to win privileges and immunities clause under Article 4 before the Civil War, won civil rights in some ways through equal protection and due process under the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, then won criminal procedure protections in the early 1900s. So there's been a really long history of corporations fighting and winning individual rights under the Constitution.
Can you put that in perspective with cases about individuals winning rights, the historical perspective?
Some of the most fundamental stories we tell about the Constitution and American political development is really about movements of people who were left out of the original promise of we the people, but fought to win inclusion and gain equal rights. So we think of the civil rights movement and the struggle by African Americans to win equal rights. And we think of the women's rights movement and in more recent years, the LGBT movement, where we're seeing these movements of people who feel like they haven't gotten the full panoply of rights, but they're making claims upon society that they're worthy of getting those equal rights too. And that's an important part of our story. Perhaps the underbelly of that story that we haven't really told before, but that my book focuses on, is how corporations have fought to become part of we the people too. That corporations, although they don't march in the street with signs demanding equal rights and corporate personhood, they've been fighting for 200 years in the Supreme Court and won a large number of rights under the Constitution, and in some ways have had a more successful civil rights movement over the years than women or minorities who, let's face it, the Supreme Court turned away very consistently up until the 1950s.
So your book goes back 200 years to cases over corporate rights. Tell us about the very first case.
To put it in some perspective, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans, Dred Scott, wasn't decided until 1857. And the first Supreme Court case on the rights of women wasn't decided until 1873, Bradwell versus Illinois. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations, by contrast, was decided a half century earlier, in 1809. And it's a case called Bank of the United States versus DeVoe. And it is one of the neglected landmarks of American law, where corporations claimed that they were citizens under Article 3 of the Constitution and entitled to sue in federal court in what your listeners will remember from law school is known as diversity jurisdiction, where citizens of one state are entitled under Article 3 to have access to federal courts so that they can sue citizens of another state. And the Bank of the United States, at the time the most powerful corporation in America, went to the Supreme Court arguing that it should be protected too by this constitutional provision, even though the provision itself very specifically refers to citizens having that right, and corporations clearly weren't citizens. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the corporation and the Bank of the United States and said that corporations could claim the protection of Article 3 and the right to sue in federal court, a right, by the way, that in 1857, in the Dred Scott case, the Supreme Court would say does not extend to African Americans.
In all these legal battles, what were corporations trying to get? Were they just trying to get away from government interfering with their actions?
Essentially, yes. Corporations seek constitutional rights for the same reasons individuals see constitutional rights is that they want to limit government power and create spaces of autonomy where they can operate without the government interfering. What's challenging is that when we think of that for individuals, we think of that as a realm of personal liberty and freedom, but corporations are using these same rights to escape business regulation, laws that are passed to regulate corporations and businesses and the economy in the interest of the public, in the interest of consumers and investors and the environment. And corporations use these rights to strike down laws that regulate business. That's essentially what happens in Citizens United, where the court says that laws that restrict business corporations from spending their money on election ads, that law was held to be unconstitutional. It violated the Constitution, so they struck down that law. And in Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court held that corporations have religious liberty rights under a federal statute, at least, the court said those rights entitled the corporation, a business corporation, to an exemption from a law requiring big employers to provide birth control for their employees in their insurance programs. So corporations have always, in the pursuit of profit, have sought to limit government regulation of them.
Was there any time in our history when there was a significant pushback against corporate rights?
We have seen some periods of pushback, but we should definitely note that one of the stories that I think really comes out of We the Corporations is that the Supreme Court really has been extremely business-friendly for a long time, and that we think of the Supreme Court as liberal or conservative, especially, you know, with the Supreme Court up for grabs in presidential elections. Our tendency is to think of these things as left or right. But one thing that unites justices over the course of American history is a strong leaning in favor of capitalism and in favor of corporate capitalism and ruling in favor of constitutional rights for corporations. One surprise rising justice who was opposed to expansive rights for corporations was the much reviled Roger Taney. And Roger Taney, who wrote the Dred Scott opinion and is not well liked by historians these days for his racist views, nonetheless had one characteristic that many reformers today might appreciate, which was that he was a reformer of corporations who thought corporations should not have expansive rights. And he refused to extend certain rights, such as the privileges or immunities under Article 4, to business corporations.
You talk about a host of legal and political legends in history. I'm particularly interested in Justice Louis Brandeis.
Well, Justice Louis Brandeis was one of the most influential thinkers about the corporation around the turn of the century. And Brandeis, even before he joined the Supreme Court, really became known for recognizing that corporations had grown so large in the era of the trust that they presented a very specific kind of corruption, a new kind of corruption that we hadn't seen before. And it's the corruption that comes from large businesses having access to other people's money. And it becomes a common theme in what we think of as the big public corporation, which is that management can use the resources of the corporation, and because the shareholders are so many and so diverse and each share is not worth the effort and the time to organize, that management really can violate their fiduciary duties almost at whim and use the resources of the corporation for their own personal uses. And one of the things they were doing was giving money to elected officials. And Brandeis was very involved in the big reform effort at the turn of the century that led to the very first campaign finance laws, the Tillman Act, passed by Congress in 1907, which banned corporate contributions to candidates. And those laws are obviously the kinds of laws that are called into question by cases like Citizens United. Although 100 years ago, when courts confronted the first cases challenging those campaign finance laws brought by companies that wanted to influence elections, courts back then said corporations don't have the right to influence elections. But that's a lesson that seems to be perhaps lost on the Supreme Court today.
So, Adam, you did so much research on this, and as I said before, you went into the lives and the histories of so many historical figures. Did one stand out to you as your favorite?
Well, I will say the book was tremendously fun to write because there were so many great figures. I really fell in love with Daniel Webster as a great character, one of the greatest Supreme Court advocates of all time, who argued more than 220 cases in the Supreme Court back in the early 1800s when many of the provisions of the Constitution were first being interpreted. He was often a lawyer for corporations, and turned out many of his most important cases were cases arguing for the rights of corporations. And so he was a fascinating character. But perhaps none is more interesting than Roscoe Conkling, who was one of the framers and drafters of the 14th Amendment. Amendment, who 20 years later went to the Supreme Court as a lawyer for the Southern Pacific Railroad and told the justices a fanciful tale that the 14th Amendment was intended to protect not just the rights of the newly freed slave after the Civil War, but was also intended to protect the rights of business corporations. And it turns out that Conkling was just lying to the justices. But nonetheless, ultimately, the Supreme Court did rule that corporations had those rights under the 14th Amendment. And the years to follow, the Supreme Court would read the 14th Amendment very narrowly in the context of African American rights, but very broadly in the context of the rights of business corporations.
I want to go into a little more depth on Citizens United. There are very few cases, Supreme Court cases, that the average person knows the name of. But Citizens United is one of them. Why has it had such an indelible impression on so many people?
Well, I think that this concern about corporations buying influence and gaining too much power in America has been a consistent theme in American life, going all the way back to the revolutionary days. I tell the story in the book about the Boston Tea Party, and that was really in part a protest against the world's largest corporation at the time, the East India Company, that had received a big bailout from the British government, and that bailout included the right to sell tea in the colonies for the first time without using American middlemen. And so the Boston Tea Party was a revolt of those middlemen who were upset being cut out of the tea trade, and they targeted the tea that night that belonged to the East India Company particularly. And so there's this theme that runs through American history, and it really has ramped up with Citizens United. And I think it comes in part on the heels of 30 years of feeling that corporations and wealthy individuals have gained ever more power, both in the campaign finance system in general, but in society more generally. And people feel that Citizens United is sort of really one of those key turning points where people realized that the fix was in favor of corporations rather than in favor of individuals.
Is the Roberts Court one of the most pro-business courts in our history?
Well, there have been studies that look at this. Of course, it's very hard to figure out exactly what your metric is and how to figure out what your standard is of the most business friendly. Every court hears different cases in different eras. But there are studies such as Lee Epstein and Richard Posner's study on justices going back all the way to the New Deal era, and they find that the Roberts Court is the most business-friendly court and that justices like Sam Alito and John Roberts are among the most business-friendly justices ever to sit on the Supreme Court, at least since the New Deal era. And if we look in terms of corporate rights, it certainly seems like this is a very, very corporate-friendly court. In recent years, the Supreme Court has expanded the free speech rights of business corporations to include not only the right of political speech under Citizens United, but expansive rights of commercial speech, too, to take out advertisements and speak in the marketplace of goods, and has also expanded the rights of religious liberty for corporations, first under a federal statute in the Hobby Lobby case. And just this past June, although the court didn't say so explicitly, certainly implicitly said that corporations have religious liberty rights under the First Amendment, too, in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. So we are seeing a court that certainly, in the context of constitutional rights, seems committed to a very expansive view, one far more expansive than even the views of the notoriously business-friendly Lochner Court of 100 years ago.
So the big question that people ask, are corporations people?
Well, corporations are people in some ways. You know, the idea of corporate personhood, although it's very controversial, goes back a long, long time. If you go back in the 1770s and you can read the famous Blackstone's commentaries on the law of England, he describes a corporation as an artificial person, even back then. The idea of corporate personhood is pretty misunderstood, I think. People think that that's the linchpin of constitutional rights for corporations, that they have rights because the Supreme Court treats them just like people. But it turns out to be much more ambiguous than that. It turns out when you look at the history of the Supreme Court, in most of the cases expanding the rights of business corporations, the court doesn't say that corporations are people. It says that corporations are associations, and they're made up of people, and that we have to protect the rights of those people who come together to form the corporation. And sometimes when you think about what corporate personhood means in the law, it means generally that a corporation is its own independent entity in the eyes of the law, with separate legal rights and separate legal duties from the people who form it, including the shareholders and owners and managers and employees. So many of the constitutional rights cases seem to reject that tenet of separation, of separate corporate personhood, and instead just say corporations can assert the rights of its members.
What's the next fight, the next frontier for corporations?
Corporations are very, very aggressively expanding on the rights that they currently have. There's not a lot of new rights they need. Corporations haven't really sought the right to keep and bear arms, but, you know, with the NRA going the way it's going, maybe that'll be next on the agenda. But what we're seeing is very aggressive and assertive use of the First Amendment, for instance. A recent study found that 50% of First Amendment cases brought in the federal courts today are brought by business corporations or trade associations that represent business, fighting back against laws trying to regulate their advertising. And I think that we're seeing trends in the Supreme Court that led Justice Kagan recently to talk about the First Amendment being weaponized, used to be able to strike down business regulation, areas of traditional government authority to regulate business.
So, Adam, why did you decide to write this book, and how much research went into it? How many years of research, I assume?
About 3 years more than I had intended. that's the way it goes. Well, so the origin of the book really comes from when I first started out as a scholar, I was working on the area of regulation of corporate money and politics, and there wasn't a lot of interest in the topic back 20 years ago. And so I sort of switched my focus to focus on the Second Amendment, thinking that, oh, that'll be a topic at least someone will pay attention to. And then the Supreme Court decided Citizens United in 2010, and I knew from right then that I was going to have to write a book about the constitutional rights of corporations, because the truth is we learn about so many rights movements in law school today. Law students will learn about civil rights and women's rights, gay rights, immigrant rights. Even they'll learn about states' rights. But they haven't really learned about corporate rights, and they haven't thought about this problem in quite this way. And there's no constitutional law textbook that you open up and has a section on the rights of corporations. But maybe it's time we start thinking about it in those terms, because corporations really have fought aggressively and successfully to win nearly all the rights that they need under the Constitution. And they use those rights to fight back against the laws that we pass to regulate business.
Thanks for being on Bloomberg Law, Adam. That's Adam Winkler of UCLA Law School. His latest book is We the Corporations. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Law Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and on Bloomberg.com/podcasts. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.